Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We will update the swine flu story now and swine flu preparedness, and we'll ask again today if the world isn't overreacting to this at the cost of more pain than gain, perhaps. But let's talk first to a leading light from the Mexican-American community here in New York, Zarela Martinez, owner of Zarela's Restaurant on 2nd Avenue between 50th and 51st Streets in Manhattan. Hi, Zarela. Welcome back to WNYC, and I'm sorry it's under these circumstances.
Well, it's always great to be here.
We had a soundbite on our local news this morning of somebody from a much smaller neighborhood Mexican restaurant describing what was happening at her place yesterday, and she was saying it was kind of deserted. People seemed afraid to come out and congregate, or maybe they were afraid to eat Mexican food even. I don't know. Are you experiencing anything like that at Zarela's?
Well, yes, actually we are. We were quiet on Sunday, and we were quiet yesterday, and I hadn't even, you know, put two and two together until last night. We were invited to go to this filmmaker, you know, Latin American filmmakers party, and one of my friends said, "Do you think it's safe to go? You know, that are we going to get the swine flu?" And I said, "Yeah, Jill, we're not going to get this. It would not do for us to die of swine flu." You know, people tend to overreact in all these things, and I think the Mexican consulate is, and the local authorities are really trying very hard to avoid a panic situation. But it, you know, unfortunately, it does affect businesses.
Unfortunately so. Well, you could serve me lunch today. I'd be happy to eat your food.
Thank you.
And take my life in my hands. Ha, ha, ha. Did that event happen, by the way, at the filmmaker?
Yeah, and everybody had a ball, it was packed, you know. But, you know, they're advising you don't kiss people. You know how Mexicans love to kiss everybody. And don't shake hands, and, you know, wash your hands often, and I think those are just general health guidelines that need to be followed in any case, for any kind of, you know, outbreak or even just general health.
Of course. We're getting confirmed new cases crossing the wire. Now there's one in the Middle East for the first time. We'll talk to a public health expert coming up after you. But you were telling my producer about a relative of yours in Mexico in a hard-hit area who was supposed to take part in a big local event there. Who is that?
Well, it's my sister who lives in Aguascalientes, a state in central Mexico, where they, you know, in Mexico, the festivals are a very important source of economic, you know, source for all the people for the entire year. And people are overreacting in Aguascalientes, and they canceled the Feria de San Marcos, which is, you know, a long, long event. So it's a hard-hit area, but it's, I think, there again, I think people are overreacting.
Why do you think it's overreaction even there if it is a hard-hit area? I mean, here in New York, all we have is these cases connected to the high school in Queens and maybe one other public school there. Nobody even seriously ill from this disease, which, you know, maybe makes it a different circumstance. Why do you think it's an overreaction even there?
Well, because I don't think that they have the same health resources that we do here. And you know, people are not quite as informed, and, you know, they don't have, you know, the TV and all the guidance that we have here. I think that's probably what's happening, because there have actually not been that many cases reported there.
What are the consequences for that town of the cancellation of that festival?
Oh, it's just devastating. It's devastating because that provides income for a lot of people for the entire year. And it's the one main tourist attraction there. But, you know, but the borders are open and people are encouraged to go and all of that. But the Feria de San Marcos is not going to happen this year, unfortunately. Unless they change their mind, you know, the next week or two.
I guess what's really worrisome is the death rate. If all these numbers are accurate, 150 deaths roughly from 1,600 cases roughly, that's about a 1 in 10 death rate if those numbers are really meaningful. But 1,600 cases only out of a city of 20 million people, Mexico City, it's not like it's everywhere you turn. But again, people are still getting to know what it actually is and what it actually means. Do you know any Mexicans here, Zarela, of your acquaintance or by second or third-hand acquaintance, in New York who have gotten this flu?
No, not a single one. I think that yesterday that there was some, a little girl, you know, was interviewed on CNN, and, you know, she's fully recovered. And so I don't know anybody who has gotten it.
And I'm still wondering a little, and we have a public health expert who we're going to talk to right now, but if we're really importing this from Mexico to here, if no one in the Mexican immigrant community appears to have gotten it, Mexicans go back and forth a lot more than these high school kids. So I don't know. Does that seem odd to you at all?
Yes, it does. So maybe it started here. You know, you never know.
Maybe the high school kids in Queens brought it to Mexico and it started from there. I don't know. But are non-Mexican people looking at you with fear as you walk down the street here in the city?
Not exactly looking at me with fear, but, you know, but people do question me about, you know, what do I think about this?
So what precautions are you taking at Zorellas?
Well, you know, we're putting up the signs, the general guidelines, you know, cover your face, you know, when you sneeze, just the same health guidelines that we have for our employees in any case, you know, wash your hands constantly, you know, cover your nose, and actually maybe I should even put up a sign there, you know, at the restaurant for the customers just not to worry about it, you know, near the bathrooms.
Zorella Martinez, owner of Zorella's Restaurant on 2nd Avenue between 50th and 51st Streets in Manhattan. Zorella, hang in there. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Latest coming out of Mexico City now from the Associated Press. It says the swine flu epidemic crossed new borders today with the first cases confirmed in the Middle East and the Asia-Pacific region as World Health officials said they suspect that American patients may have transmitted the virus to others in the United States. The number of deaths blamed on the virus has surpassed 150, all in the Mexico City area. And I know everyone is worried about this right now, but before you start avoiding Mexican restaurants and before the city, how about this? Maybe the city should issue a travel advisory to Queens. Let's ask ourselves if the reaction may be more dangerous than the disease. This outbreak couldn't be a luckier thing for my next guest, and I hate to put it that way, but he's a public health expert at Hunter College and Yale who has just released a book called Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to Avian Flu. Philip Alcaldes is taking a few minutes out from teaching a class to join us right now. Philip, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure, Brian. I have to say I don't feel lucky, although it's true that the timing was certainly fortuitous.
And you remind us that all flu pandemic preparedness stems from the horrible Spanish flu outbreak of 1918 that killed 40 million people and was not widely feared until it was too late. What was the Spanish flu and where did it strike?
Well, the so-called Spanish flu, I like to call it the 1918 epidemic because it wasn't really Spanish, seems to have begun in the United States, swept around the world, and nobody knows exactly how many people died, but the estimates start at 30 or 40 million and go up from there. And and you're right. I'm very concerned about the casual use of the term pandemic in the current situation because I think it reminds people of a horror fantasy that there might be a return of the 1918 situation. In fact, I don't see this as a great crisis, at least not yet. Maybe it's going to go there, but what we know so far is, last I saw, 152 deaths in and around Mexico City. Now, that's awful. 150-something people dying. Maybe some or maybe all of them have died of this new strain of flu. It's a very sad reminder that nature remains red in tooth and claw. And a lot of them are young people, and that's, you know, another sad reminder that nature's bite is sometimes untoward and untimely. But 150 deaths, sad as it is, that's the equivalent of, that's 20 minutes worth of diarrhea in kids around the world.
Fatal diarrhea.
Fatal diarrhea.
Kids around the world.
It's 2 hours worth of malaria in kids in Africa. And that's how many people die, how many kids die of malaria every 2 hours in Africa. And if you don't like my playing the poor kids card, it's a single bad weekend on American highways. Actually, it's not even a bad weekend. It's a single average weekend.
Right. Although I don't know if risk comparisons are reason enough not to take precautions against a small but new risk.
Exactly. That we must plan, and I really like it that President Obama has supported the public health efforts and systems that are in place and, as far as I can see, are being used perfectly appropriately. He's not making the mistake that Gerry Ford made back in 1976. Some of us are old enough to remember the last time swine flu came around, 1976, when there was a national immunization campaign begun by the feds basically on bad advice from some scientists. And there was no swine flu outbreak in the U.S. There were a few cases. But people developed a serious neurological disorder, Guillain-Barré syndrome, and there were 32 deaths from that.
So more deaths from the vaccine than may have even occurred from the swine flu, because the disease, as you put it in the book, the enemy declined to show up.
Yes, exactly. That's how I say it in the book. The point I want to make here, and that I make in the book, is that I'm not a skeptic about vaccines. I am a skeptic about making plans in advance of the facts.
And then you also use the avian flu or bird flu scare of 1997 as a classic case of media hype. Remind us what happened in 1997.
Well, it was actually a little longer than that, but from 1997, when the first human cases of this H5N1 avian flu became apparent, well into this decade, there have been periodic announcements about avian flu becoming the next pandemic. And again, I think that's been an appeal to not to reality, but to a fantasy scenario. Once again, avian flu is a public health problem. It needs to be addressed, but it wasn't the pandemic it wasn't a reprise of 1918.
Did people underreact to 1918, and that's why we overreact now?
It's not a fair comparison. This isn't 1918. And for one thing, we've got much better public health systems. We have better science. We know about much more about viruses. We know much more about flu virus in particular. But the really big difference is we've invested in public health infrastructure and personnel in a way that hadn't happened yet in 1918. We couldn't possibly have responded appropriately in 1918.
Philip Alcaldes teaches urban public health at Hunter, teaches in the nursing school at Yale, and is the author now of Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to the Avian Flu. I want to throw a few stats at you that are coming out of this situation and see if you can help us make sense of them. First, just on how the public health officials are characterizing this to us, which might be a mixed message. I think they're generally getting high marks. But we just heard on the news at the top of the hour how the World Health Organization is now rating this a 4 on its 6-point pandemic scale. Not a pandemic, but it's a 4 on that scale. And yet it's not even an epidemic by their labeling. How are people supposed to synthesize those? Oh, it's a 4 out of 6 on the pandemic scale, but no, it's not an epidemic. What does that actually mean?
Oh, I can't really speak for WHO. I've never worked there. I don't know what it's like, but I think they've got a problem. They're stuck because the WHO in general can't act unless they're invited by member countries. So their situation is they've got member countries who are concerned about this new outbreak, who are beginning to implement public health controls. What can they do from Geneva? Well, they can crank up the threat barometer.
Right. But here's a quote from an official of the WHO, the World Health Organization. He says, at this time, containment is not a feasible option. Meaning there is phase 4 means there is sustained human-to-human transition, causing outbreaks in at least one country. WHO's pandemic alert system was revised after bird flu in Asia began to spread in 2004. Monday was the first time it has ever been raised above phase three, and that's the reason that Keiji Fukuda, Assistant Director General of the WHO, gave. He said, at this time, containment is not a feasible option. Do you understand that statement, and do you agree with it?
I've written that, and I believe that public health officials have to be much, much more careful about how they use terminology, because most people don't understand technical terms in technical ways. Containment is one of them. So is pandemic and even epidemic. I think it's a really good idea to deliver information, and I think WHO is trying to do that. But officials aren't always aware of the way that their phrases are misunderstood. Containment in particular, that makes it sound like, you know, we have no chance, this is going to spread out of control and we're all going to die. And I think that's the wrong thing to say. I don't think that Fukuda believes that. I don't think that's what he means.
Here's another stat or comparison of two statistics. The official number for Mexico, and this may be way low, but the official number for Mexico now is 1,600 cases of this swine flu with 150 deaths. Now, as I was saying to the last guest, that would be an incredibly frightening death rate if one out of every 10 people who gets the disease then dies from the disease. But on the other hand, Mexico City is a city of 20 million people, the whole metro area, so 1,600 cases is actually not that many. So again, how do we synthesize those stats, the scary death rate, but the really very low prevalence rate, and take any meaning from it?
I think the answer is, it's not time to try to synthesize the data yet. And this is what I mean about the fallacy of projecting in advance of the fact. We don't know how many people in Mexico City were infected. We have no idea what the transmissibility is like. It looks, if you divide 152 deaths by 1,600 cases, it looks like a very high, what epidemiologists call case fatality ratio, very high probability of dying if you get this in Mexico City. On the other hand, the cases in the U.S. have been uniformly mild to moderate, and that seems to be true of cases elsewhere. So all the facts aren't in yet, and we ought not to think of this as a crisis and start instituting panicky procedures.
Here's another stat, and again, I mentioned it to Zarella Martinez, who was on just before you, and I don't know if you'll even want to take a stab at interpreting this, but the number of Mexican-Americans who have apparently gotten this in the United States, as far as we know, is zero. And if you're supposed to be getting it by going to Mexico on spring break or something like that, or having contact with Mexicans, well, who goes back and forth to Mexico more than Mexican Americans? And yet there doesn't seem to be any disease rate here in New York, for example, where most of the cases are in the United States. There seems to be a zero disease rate against Mexican Americans, and at least on the face of it, this makes no sense.
You know, Brian, you're getting at something that's a main theme in the book that I just wrote. The history of epidemics, in Western culture at least, is a history of people's fears about disease threats being used to satisfy or promote political or moral agendas. And I'm worried that we're going to start hearing from the anti-immigrationists that, you know, we should build the border fences even higher, or we're going to start hearing from ideologues that this shows that there's something wrong with, you know, either capitalism on the one hand or Obama's supposed socialism on the other hand, take your pick, that people with agendas are going to start making use of this fear to promote their thinking in ways that really have nothing to do with the public health situation.
And I think there are three scary words in this that probably raise it in the imagination beyond what it may be as a public health threat: pigs, birds, and Mexico.
Yeah, that's a good point. We do sometimes get nuts about birds, as avian flu reminded us, and I think West Nile virus and crows.
There was, by the way, a fairly substantial avian flu outbreak in 2004 or so, wasn't there?
Avian flu seems to kind of pulsate as it travels around the world, and sometimes you get these human outbreaks. It's essentially impossible. I was going to say hard, but it's essentially impossible to track avian flu by looking only at humans. In fact, I would say it's a mistake. What we have to do with flu in general is think much more, I'll use the term holistically, about the nexus of humans and animals, different kinds of animals, and particularly the animals we eat and the humans who have to live close in close quarters with animals that we eat.
Here is a victim of this flu in a way. It's one of the kids who actually has it. I don't know if you read this paragraph in the New York Times today. Poor Esty LaMonica, one of the students at St. Francis School in Queens, it says in the Times, her parents had ordered her not to take off the mask until her symptoms went away. And they made a quarantine sign to hang on the doorknob of her bedroom. No reaction.
Poor
You're speechless.
Girl. Yeah, speechless, exactly.
Maybe that's where we have to leave it. What do you think of Mexico City's response? They seem pretty scared of themselves right now.
I think that it from what I've read, and I only know what's been in the news reports, I don't have first-hand information, but it seems to me that they're taking the right actions. It may be that they're over-challenged in terms of what resources they've got, but closing the schools, temporary bans on public gatherings, investigation of cases, isolation, those are the right things to do.
We'll give the last word to a listener named Caitlin, who posted this on our webpage. I've been getting all sorts of extra room around me on the train this week, thanks to my seasonal allergies. Thanks, swine flu. And with that, we leave it with Philip Alcaldes, professor of urban public health at Hunter College. He also teaches at Yale, and his brand new book is called Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics. From the Black Death to Avian Flu. Professor Alcaldes, thank you for coming on with us and taking some time out from your class. I hope your students got to listen in on this. They might have learned something. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up in a minute, and by sheer coincidence, another guest is going to tell us not to be so afraid. Lenore Skenazy wrote the book Free Range Kids. She's that columnist who let her 9-year-old son ride the subway by himself. Lenore Skenazy in a minute.